It is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Florida's third education commissioner in 3 years quit this week, just after 8 months on the job. Tony Bennett said leaving was his decision to ensure the focus the agency remains on Florida school kids.
It's not fair to the children of Florida that I continue as commissioner and deal with the distractions.
Now, Bennett came under scrutiny after the Associated Press reported this week he was involved in changing school performance grades at his previous job in Indiana. Bennett called those allegations, quote, malicious and unfounded, end quote. We have a panel of top education journalists from throughout the state of Florida. Sammy Mack covering the education beat here in South Florida with us in studio on WLRN. John O'Connor from State Impact Florida with us from WUSF. Sammy, first of all, detail these allegations that were made against Commissioner Bennett that he called distractions today.
Well, the Associated Press got their hands on a series of emails that Tony Bennett sent when he was in charge in Indiana. He had pushed through this A to F grading system of schools, which Florida actually pioneered, and he was introducing it. And if you look at the emails, he had gone to a bunch of stakeholders in Indiana when he was trying to get this through and said, you know, basically that the schools that we know to be really great schools will stay A's. And he specifically mentioned this school, Crystal House Academy, and used it as an example over and over again. Places like Crystal House will be an A. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that Crystal House is run by a prominent Republican donor and Bennett supporter. So anyway, he, according to these emails, finds out after the A to F system formula is run on the schools, Crystal House is a C. So he tells his people in writing, this doesn't work. Has them go back, change it. There's a whole lot of back and forth. And basically, he changed the formula in such a way that this school would become an A.
John, is there fire here with this smoke that the AP uncovered? Certainly, there was enough for Bennett to quit.
It's not clear yet. Certainly, there's some fire because the backlash has been tremendous, and it did not take long for Tony Bennett to realize that he was going to have to step down from his position. There's been some pushback. We've heard from Tony Bennett himself, and we've heard from the two foundations affiliated with Governor Bush that this is kind of a political hit job, and that when the full context of this comes out, that we'll understand it. They've also made the argument that, in fact, 13 schools in total were affected by this change, and all of them saw their grades go up. So it wasn't just this one charter school that was affected.
These are 13 However, schools, though, in the state of Indiana. 13 schools in the entire state that were affected by this formula change.
Right. However, the counter argument to that, though, is that they named this particular charter school, Crystal House Academy, by name in these emails. And so, the emails, when you read them, do make it sound like they were targeting this particular school's grade, and that anybody else that got caught up was just, part of getting this school to an A.
Mark Caputo, who writes a political column for the Miami Herald, also joining us in the studio here at WLRN in Miami. And Mark, you heard an audible sigh when John mentioned former Governor Bush and the connection here that he had with Commissioner Bennett.
Well, the problem I think that Bush's foundation has is that its statement instantly decried that this was a political attack, and thereby injected more politics into it.
So first of all, give us the connection between Commissioner Bennett, former Governor Bush, and one of his two foundations.
Governor Jeb Bush was a leading proponent of school reform. He was the education governor, whether you liked him or not.
That's right.
In Florida. He has continued to do that work. He believes in grading schools. He believes in more school choice. And as a result, his foundation is a nationally recognized clearinghouse to put together governments and governmental workers or leaders to advance the idea of school reform and school choice. The problem that Tony Bennett has, if you look at the emails that the AP uncovered, is he expressed an inordinate amount of interest in the success of the school in his grading system. If you listen to his explanation, it's rational as well, that basically this school fell within a gray area, and there's no way, knowing how good the school was, that it would do so badly. And therefore, it didn't quite fit the template that was supposed to be used for the various schools. But then they fall victim to their own criticism. Mm-hmm. The criticism of school grading is that it's too rigid and too inflexible. But what happens when a donor and school choice poster child comes along, well, we now need to change the grades, but we won't do that for public schools that, say, have Title I problems, poverty problems, and the like that really make education a little more difficult.
Yeah, and just for a little bit of context on that point, the school that's being held up, Crystal House Academy, our partners in Indiana, at State Impact Indiana, had done a profile on the school. And what makes it interesting and why it had a reputation in Indiana is because it is this charter school that has 95% of students qualifying for free or reduced lunch. And compared to other schools in the state of Indiana that have that kind of population with a lot of kids coming from poverty and a lot less advantage, its test scores were always well above everybody else's. However, when they ran the formula, they weren't A grades.
The original formula.
Right.
Prior to the change in the methodology
right.
that Commissioner Bennett
right. Their,
is accused
their
10th of.
Grade math scores were not enough to make it into that original formula as an A school.
Sammy Mack with WLRN, John O'Connor with State Impact Florida, WUSF, and Mark Caputo, Miami Herald political columnist, all with us here on the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson. Join the conversation online. It is at WLRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at WLRN and call in 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. John O'Connor with State Impact Florida. How does this one methodology question with one school 800 miles away cost the commissioner of education in Florida his job just 8 months into his tenure?
It's pretty simple, really, in that when you're in a position like the education commissioner, policy is the most important thing. And so if politics all of a sudden become a bigger issue and overshadow the policy, then you know, you're a distraction mm-hmm. and it's time for you to leave your job. And, you know, we talked to a bunch of people yesterday who kind of reiterated that point time and time again. I talked with John Legge, the chairman of the Senate Education Committee, and I said, look, if he feels like he did the right thing here, why doesn't he stand and fight?
Right.
And Legge's answer was he just can't because, you know, these policies are important and he needs to go.
Talk to us about why he can't. Is it something within Bennett or something within the education regulation system, regulatory system here in the state of Florida, Mark?
It's Rick Scott.
Now we have the current governor introduced here, which we do need to talk a little bit about. But why do you say it's Rick Scott is why Bennett resigned?
Tony Bennett is the sixth top Scott pick since the governor took office in the winter of 2011.
In this education job.
Well, in the education job, there's, what, one or two before him. Mm-hmm. Overall, there's six. You can't divorce these. This is not just an education story. This is the fact that Governor Scott is running for re-election.
And we're going to get into that. But, John, take us back to January when Bennett was announced as the commissioner of the Department of Education for the state of Florida. Why did he get the job?
The biggest reason was he is an acknowledged expert on Common Core state standards, which are education standards that Florida and 44 other states are working to implement right now. They're scheduled to, you know, if you've got kids in kindergarten or first grade, they're already using the standards. Second graders are going to start using them this year. They'll be fully implemented starting at the beginning of the next school year. Bennett, you know, has been a leader on these things. He's been a leader in the new tests that are going to accompany the standards. And so that was the biggest reason why the State Board of Education hired him. Another reason is he was thought to be the guy who could finally bring some stability to this position that has had such turnover in the last couple of years since Governor Scott took office.
Obviously, talking about state standards, you got to introduce the aspect of parents in here. Robin is with the Public Insight Network here on WLRN, Miami Herald News, calling us from Pembroke Pines. Robin, give us your thoughts as a parent of a school child in this ouster of the education chief over testing formulas.
Thank you for having me. As a parent, and also I also teach, so I see students that come from A schools, and yet they cannot write, they do not read well, their vocabulary is poor. My own kids, I have one kid with Asperger's, so she's in gifted, but she tests very poorly at times, depending upon the stress put on her, and she has other emotional problems that come with the stress that is put on for testing. So at the end of the day, you have one kid that's tested, and you have all these other kids that are tested, but one size does not fit all. The community, I looked at the scores and I compared them. They were very low on one side. The wealthier the community, the higher the scores were. It's simply not that they don't take in special needs. It's one size simply does not fit all. And then by the time a lot of these kids come to me, they can't do homework. They don't even know what 10% of a number is. They can't figure anything out. So Florida is so proud of their administrative abilities, but they're still ranked very low nationally, as they always have been most of my life.
Robin calling us from Pembroke Pines here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN. Sammy, you hear the frustration as a parent and as a teacher there, talking about just the topic that Mark brought up, the rigidity of the test of the tests, which are criticized. And then when there is flexibility introduced, that certainly can be ground for criticism as well.
Yeah, I mean, there are a million different ways that testing and standardized testing has been sort of under the microscope and criticized in Florida. And that is absolutely something that I've heard from parents before about the stress of the test, the amount of the tests. We're going to be phasing in new tests in 2014. We don't even know what those tests are going to be, which actually, so Florida is moving towards this Common Core standard. Florida is part of a consortium of 45 states and D.C., and part of that also means that there's going to be a different kind of test for that. And Tony Bennett was in a position where he was about to sort of start to make that decision. And now that he's out, there's concern, okay, what happens next?
And you get the criticism for the administrators and that kind of role of the leaders here. And Sammy, you had a unique opportunity to speak to the leader of the largest school district in the state of Florida, the superintendent of Miami-Dade Public Schools, about the commissioner quitting, but also talking about really what's at stake and what local administrators need to keep focused on.
Yeah, I spoke to Alberto Carvalho yesterday, and he was talking about this fact that we've had 3 full-time and 2 interim education commissioners in just 5 years, or sorry, in just 3 years.
There's never enough time for a commissioner, or for that matter, a superintendent or a principal or a teacher, to adapt to the new reality before it changes again. And that revolving door attitude of policy implementation creates political friction that often becomes very noisy and very challenging to the position itself.
You know, and at the same time, he was also trying to sort of put it into perspective, but, you know.
Yeah, I mean, some have said here, Mark, that maybe this education commissioner ought to be an elected position. That certainly isn't going to delete politics from the education industry in the state of Florida.
Well, it used to be until 2002.
And then it wasn't.
And correct.
Look at where we are now is my point.
You can't take politics out of a political system. You can make it elected or appointed, but in the end, it is what it is.
Yeah.
And it should be stated that Education Week, which is held to be kind of a gold standard, has found Florida to be improving under the school grading system that owes its genesis to Jeb Bush and to a degree for Lawton Childs before him, who was the original progenitor of the FCAT. It was Bush that brought in more of the high-stakes grading system. So we can't say it's a complete failure, but certainly, as we've said on this program, it does cause friction.
It does cause a lot of friction. And Sammy, to Superintendent Carvalho's point, the friction is up on high in Tallahassee in the halls of power, but it's felt at kitchen tables and classrooms across the state.
Right. I asked him how this changes the way that he does his job, and you know, he said, basically, look, parents and teachers, they're more concerned about the day-to-day.
What I know is August 19th is the very first day of school, and teachers are going to report to schools with the anticipation that it's going to be a great school year. Parents are going to bring their our beautiful children back to school, and they're not going to care about who the commissioner is. They're going to care about whether or not the school is clean, the type of educational programs they have, and what their, you know, kindergarten teacher's name is. And I think that's the concern in the minds of parents, and that's the reality that I'm dealing with right now. Obviously, from a policy perspective, what the commissioner does is important. But in as much as parents are somewhat detached from that, my role as superintendent is to insulate parents from the controversies and from sort of this merry-go-round sort of attitude that we see in Tallahassee.
Putting the concentration back on the classroom and the kids and the parents where it probably ought to be, the superintendent of the Miami-Dade Public Schools reacting this week to the news of the state of Florida Education Commissioner Tony Bennett quitting his job after just 8 months. We still have more to come here on the Florida Roundup. He was the 4th Department of Ed leader to quit during Governor Scott's administration. We'll talk more about the politics. And later on here on the Florida Roundup, it's a week after the Hialeah massacre, 6 dead plus the shooter. We'll talk gun violence and our neighborhoods. It's the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. We've got a quartet of top journalists from throughout the state of the Sunshine here in Florida. John O'Connor, State Impact Florida, joining us from WUSF. Sammy Mack from WLRN. And Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald with me here in studio. And Adam Smith from the Tampa Bay Times joining us from the from Tampa Bay as we talk education and politics. Your questions also welcome here on the panel. Email us with your first name and location, the Florida Roundup, thefloridaroundup@gmail.com. You can call us up at 800-743-WLRN, 800-743-WLRN, and tweet us using the call sign at WLRN. Live blog online at WLRN.org. Lots of ways to communicate with us here on the radio and online. Again, to our guests, John O'Connor, State Impact of Florida, WUSF. What happens here now? The new interim state education commissioner is the former interim state education commissioner.
Right, and she'll bring a little bit of continuity to the position here, you know, better than what might have happened otherwise, because she has that experience. Obviously, one of the biggest statewide policy issues with education right now is Common Core implementation. She's got quite a bit of experience with that.
This is Pam Stewart. Pam Stewart is the interim. Yeah.
Right. So she has some experience with those issues, and she'll be able to kind of jump right in and get running.
So she was interim. She's interim yet again. Adam Smith from Tampa Bay. We've talked already about Governor Scott and his position here. But the first governor that we mentioned in regards to the state education department was Governor Bush. It seems by the national media response to what's gone on here in Florida in education, he seems to be the biggest loser in terms of his position as a national leader for education reform.
Well, I think that there's something to that. I think most people in Florida that pay close attention have long seen Jeb Bush as really the true leader in education in this state, having much more influence than even the current governor in education. And that's a large part of why Tony Bennett, a disciple of Jeb Bush, was appointed in the first place. And it's a tough time for Jeb and all those that are favoring accountability and high-stakes testing, because you're seeing all these both on the left and the far right, opposition to Common Core. You're seeing the Florida Education Board sort of pad the grades. And for those that think it's an arbitrary system or a system that can be gamed, all this feeds into that skepticism.
Mark, how about it? How much is at risk here for Governor Scott as we move into a new election cycle?
It seems like Governor Scott can't catch a break. At the beginning of the March lawmaking session, his lieutenant governor resigned in a scandal connected to a low-rent gambling operation. He's had a series of other departures. His chief of staff before her appeared to be wiring the halls of government so that his friends who happen to have certain contracts or get into certain positions were able to profit from them. It's just gone on and on and on. A lot of this is bad luck, but certainly Rick Scott is the chief executive, and you have to take responsibility for the government or the agencies you lead, and he leads them. And this certainly doesn't help the governor. His poll numbers have remained stagnant for quite some time, mm-hmm. despite the improving economy. So this just makes a difficult haul just a little tougher.
John O'Connor, State Impact Florida, WUSF. Talk to us about this revolving door of commissioners at the Department of Education and interim commissioners. We've talked about the politics, but is this a job, the way that it has been constructed, because of the politics around education in Florida, that there simply is no ideal candidate?
Yeah, there's a lot of cooks in the kitchen when you become education commissioner in Florida. You've got the current governor, you've got a former governor who has some interest in what the state is doing. Florida's a big state, so it's important for the business of education. So content providers, curriculum providers have an interest in what's going on here. Florida is also a much more kind of politically aware state about education. I used to work in South Carolina, and they didn't talk about education nearly as much as they do in Florida. So all of these things factor into, you know, whoever is education commissioner has to serve a lot of masters. They have a very kind of fine line they have to walk in pleasing a lot of different parties. And so it is a difficult position.
All right, let's take some more calls here on WLRN, 800-743-9576, 800-743-9576. That's WLRN. Carlos from Pembroke Pines. Let's see if we can pull up his call here. We are not having success, but we will get to Carlos just as soon as we can. You can also tweet us at WLRN and join the online conversation at WLRN.org. So where does this leave us then, Sammy, as we look forward not only with the politics, but especially the policies that have been mentioned here? Not only the policies that Commissioner Bennett brought in January, the policies of Common Core, the policies of accountability and grading, those don't seem to be under attack here per se, as opposed to it's the people, it's the personalities underlying those policies. How much of the policies are going to get redebated here?
That's a really great question. I think it's a little bit too early to tell just how much attention or controversy is going to be brought back to some of these things. I mean, there is some opposition to Common Core. There is some opposition to anything that has to do with new testing for a lot of different reasons and from a lot of different areas of education stakeholders. But there are things that are in motion that are much bigger than one sort of education commissioner.
That's,
I mean,
right.
We've already started introducing Common Core standards. There are, you know, it's already been introduced in elementary school. It's going to continue to roll out. Things around, you know, digital technology, those are on the books in Florida. They're going to happen. It's just a matter of figuring out how they're going to happen and who makes those decisions. Well, we don't have a full-time education commissioner.
Still looking for leadership at the top. Well, okay, Carlos from Pembroke Pines is with us now. Carlos, welcome to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. I just want to say I grew up here in Florida since elementary. I remember taking tests all the way through junior college, which I think they were great. And I remember the class test in junior college here where they'll prepare you for universities in Florida. And I thought it was higher level than when I went to live in Arizona. And I just wonder, I didn't grow up with so much political issues in education in Florida. And I just wonder what's going on. I didn't grow up with this kind of argument sort of issues about education.
Hey. Carlos from Pembroke Pines, thanks for the phone call here on WLRN. John O'Connor, I think Carlos makes a great point. The politicization of the education industry, is that a reflection of the times? Is it a reflection of global competition? Probably also a reflection of profit motive in education.
Oh, I think it's a reflection of human nature. You're never going to be able to get politics out of just about anything where there's, you know, influence, power, money involved. Education is no different. Obviously, there's a kind of bigger picture goal, but you know, it's a reality of education. It always has been.
Mark, how about it? You've covered politics in the state for a long time. I mean, do you see that's getting ratcheted up almost year after year, month after month?
Good question. As someone who grew up in Florida and went to school from elementary on here, one of the reasons I think maybe it wasn't so politicized back then is that I didn't realize it was because I was in school.
Yeah, although you know what, Mark? I took the first FCAT, and I do remember there being conversations that the reason I wasn't reading Hamlet was because we had to study the FCAT. At this point in my life, I have no excuse for not having read Hamlet, but, you know.
Look, it could be. Understand is that under Florida's constitution is the state is essentially in charge of funding education. So this all goes through Tallahassee. This is the biggest section of the budget known as the general revenue budget. So wherever there's money and politicians, there's politics.
Yeah, Adam Smith from Tampa Bay Times, that's no different today than it was when Mark was in the classroom, when Sammy was in the classroom, than when you were in the classroom.
Right. I think it was Mark was in a – it was just a one-room schoolhouse back when he was in school.
Yeah. You had to go outside to use the restroom.
I was barefoot, too. I think. Yeah.
But no, but I think part of the factor for why it wasn't as politicized is because we had – it was the status quo for a long time, and people weren't questioning the status quo. And whether you admire him or you can't stand him, Jeb Bush and some of the Republican leaders just concluded that the status quo was not cutting it anymore, and some dramatic changes needed to be made, and those dramatic changes – went hard against some powerful, once powerful interest groups like teachers unions. Mm-hmm. And we're still seeing that. Now we're in sort of a murky area where it's sometimes hard to tell where Rick Scott's principles on education really are.
I have to say, I agree with Adam there. I remember being in 10th grade, a fellow sophomore was unable to find the United States on a map. She should not have been socially promoted. That was one of the things that Governor Bush helped put an end to.
It is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Join the conversation online, WLRN.org. Call in at 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson, Sammy Mack from WLRN along with us, John O'Connor, State Impact Florida, Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald, and Adam Smith from the Tampa Bay Times. We've got Richard joining us on the phone from Miami. Richard, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Thank you very much, gentlemen. It's a great discussion. The reality is I'm 61. I went to school down here just like everyone else. You know what? It was way back better back then. And Jeb Bush didn't really do great things for education in the state of Florida. You know, everyone kind of thinks that he's a nice guy and he's a good guy. But the reality is our education was really going down at that point. And as far as Governor Scott, you know, whoever said he had bad luck, listen, there's an old saying, the fish stinks from the head. He has plenty of experience, you know. He basically would like to privatize everything in this state. And the other thing is, you know, there is politics always involved, but now it's even worse with the charter schools. And a lot of the Republicans make a lot of money on these charter schools. Here in Dade County, half of them, are going out of business and are terrible. So the reality is, if he's the governor, let him lead. He has enough money, and he should be able to not worry that he should do what is the right thing. And as far as where he stands on education, I'm not really quite sure. You know, he's very wishy-washy, and it's his fault that he's hiring people that can't do the job.
Richard calling us from Miami. He'll have that, Richard, you'll have that option to voice your displeasure at the ballot box and not too long of a time. Also joining us from Miami is Elizabeth. Elizabeth, welcome to the Florida Roundup.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What can we do?
I was just listening to the program, and aside from the politicization of the education, it's a question of dollars and cents with the school grading system and grading the schools, and now talk of putting in this new school grading system where it would drop all the schools down a grade. So what happens with an F school? I mean, are we going to, like, go and just close up the school or put in a charter school for somebody to make money off of it? I mean, and what do you do with those kids that are now in an F school?
Sure. I know we've seen in other public education institutions elsewhere in the United States, some of those failing schools do wind up getting closed. John, what do you know about the kinds of grades that are in store for Florida public schools and what some of the repercussions are?
Well, we've seen the grades for elementary and middle schools this year, and they are down across the board. Fewer A schools, more F schools, more D schools.
And some have complained because the standards have gotten higher.
Yeah, and this is part of the switch to Common Core. That they kind of, one of the complaints about why this is happening is that they started the process late. Everybody recognized that things are going to get tougher when Common Core standards take effect. So we should kind of soften that blow by raising some of our FCAT standards and the school grading system along the way. That process got going a little late, and so some of these things are taking effect pretty rapidly here over the last 2 years. That was the complaint of the state superintendents this year when they asked for some relief from the Board of Education. As far as how these grades affect the schools, well, when you're an F-rated school, there are repercussions for that. You get interventions from the state. You get more help. You have more requirements for additional reading tutoring and things like that. So there are real repercussions for these schools that score an F grade or a lower grade.
And we've got a question on Twitter via the handle at WLRN. Nida Borres asks, Sammy, if we don't adopt Common Core, who will develop new state tests? I imagine that certainly would be something that would be completely politicized if, in fact, we are there.
Right. So there are a couple of tests, including the PARC, which we had been looking at, which is, John, help me out with the acronym here.
Partnership for Assessment of Readiness for College and Careers.
Right. There we go. It's alphabet soup in education. So so there are some tests like that are being developed sort of on a national level that would allow, you know, students in Florida to take the same tests as students in other states, mm-hmm. and compare how we are doing across the country. And for the people who support this, that is the goal, to be able to compare one student sitting in a classroom in Florida to a student sitting in a classroom in, say, New York or something. there are some states that have sort of peeled off from that, who are part of the Common Core sort of consortium, who have decided we're going to write our own tests around Common Core. But there's some question, you know, if you do that, are you really reaching a point where you can compare students across the country?
How applicable would those tests be if you were in a special case of Common Core when the core was not so common?
Right.
You're also seeing...
go ahead.
Tom, you're also seeing mainline testing companies like SAT and ACT who are going to develop Common Core aligned exams as well. So those could come in here as well.
Sure. It sounds like that's where some of the legislative leadership is heading, toward those mainline testing.
Describe that a little bit more, Adam Smith from Tampa Bay Times.
Well, you had this curious, the House Speaker and the Senate President suddenly announced that they wanted nothing to do with PARC, and they put out a statement that had left a lot of people scratching their heads. It wasn't clear were they skeptical about Common Core, or was it just the testing? They've since suggested that it's mostly the testing. But you really do. I don't think you can underestimate the impact. Some people on the right and the Tea Party are very, very skeptical about Common Core, about sort of national standards, et cetera. Yeah. You're seeing Republican executive committees pass resolutions across the state opposed to it. So I think the testing, they're not backing away from Common Core itself, but the fact that they are backed away from that particular test was sort of a bone thrown to some of those conservative skeptics.
That's Adam Smith with Tampa Bay Times, Mark Caputo, Miami Herald, Sammy Mack, WLRN, John O'Connor, State Impact Florida, WUSF, all joining me, Tom Hudson, here on the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Jenny from Key West also joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Jenny, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'd like to make some brief comments that I'd like your panel to comment on. I was listening to Chris Hayes talk about this issue yesterday on, NBC. And he says basically teachers aren't trusted. And if you want a democratic society, you need a strong public school system. I think this movement toward charter schools is disastrous. And one more comment that why don't we look at school systems that work? And one that I've researched recently is Finland, where the focus, yes, it's expensive, but the focus is on the individual student. And just as one of your earlier callers said, one size doesn't fit all. And if we put the dollars into that individualization, even though it's expensive, it would be money well spent rather than what we do spend it on. And I really think we're in big trouble in this country if we don't have a public school system.
Mark, you want to tackle the comparison to Finland?
I'll tackle a bunch of things. One, I'm from Key West, so good to hear from you. Two, my wife is a public school teacher at a Title I school here in Miami. She knows what it's like to be a teacher who's not trusted. But three, there's a problem she has. One of the union members there spends an inordinate amount of time going to union meetings and essentially dumping her kids off into my wife's classroom. Mm-hmm. So we can't ignore the fact that there are those problems. There's also, four, the problem of the Florida Constitution. While it requires uniform public schools, it also requires essentially the same amount to be spent on various schools, and our school grading system and our education system doesn't take into account the significant challenges that a lot of kids, like my wife's students, face when they come in the morning. They haven't had breakfast. They've been kept up all night by the neighbors who've been playing loud music. Their parents haven't necessarily read to all of them when they were young kids, right, and they don't know how to read, and this is second and third grade. So, yeah, it would be good to spend more money, but also let's remember, Finland is a smaller, relatively speaking, richer country. It's more unified across demographic and economic lines. We in the United States, we in Florida, face more diverse challenges.
Yeah, and also to that point, for the schools get the same amount of money, but on the books, formulas are pretty even keel about what a school is getting per kid and whatnot. But one of the things that happens is if you have a school where a lot of the kids are coming from poverty and your entire district is, say, slashing media specialists, this is something I actually saw in Jacksonville a little while ago, the schools that can afford to, that have parents that can do the fundraising, will find a way to keep those media specialists. So there's almost like a second economy around schools and school districts where there is more money in the student population's family. And so there is sort of a discrepancy on the whole around how much kids are, you know, how much is being spent in the school.
Sure.
that doesn't just have to do with the kind of funding that's coming from the state.
No, it can absolutely do with the kind of neighborhood that the school not only is geographically in, but the neighborhood and the type of population and the type of demographics that happen to populate that school. Miguel is joining us here on the Florida Roundup from Miami. Miguel, welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you for giving me the opportunity. I taught at the university level, and last year I taught biology in a public high school, an A school. And my wife teaches in a public high school, a school that's a C, D. And what I found is that there was very little difference amongst the students and the teachers, and the difference that one school is a C, D school and the other school is a strong A school is that in the C school, you have more recent immigrant students whose parents struggle financially, and these students have to work. And you have more students that don't speak English, and therefore they don't test very well.
Mm-hmm.
There was no difference in teacher performance. So this idea that you have to take a punitive approach to teachers in order to increase the school's grade just doesn't jive with the reality that I experienced. If I had to very quickly sum up what I think is the biggest problem, and if you talk to teachers, we always seem to be left out of this conversation. If you ask teachers, what is the biggest problem? The vast majority of teachers that I met and spoke with say the same thing, apathy. Students, apathy, and apathy by parents. It was not uncommon, even in an A school, for students to show up to class with nothing, no paper, no pen, nothing. And schools know that you can't flunk these students because if you do, your school grade goes down.
Miguel from Miami joining us here on the Florida Roundup. We appreciate your thoughts. And it really is this triangulation, Mark, of blame between the classroom looking at the home looking at the classroom, both of them looking at the local administration looking at the state administration. And where does the ball wind up stopping?
Well, who knows? But at least the ball is being moved.
That's right.
And at least people are talking about it. So there is a silver lining.
There is a silver
lining.
Can
I just throw in a contrarian point here that I think everybody agrees teachers are underpaid. They're arguably the single most important profession we have. But for everybody that says, you know, there was that second grade teacher that inspired them in life, I think more people recall the teachers that were mediocre to poor. and they're out there. And to just act like teachers are sacred that shouldn't be held accountable is putting blinders on.
Well, yeah, Adam, as I expressed, you know, there is a teacher in my wife's school who I think, were she not a union member and did not have these protections, she should not be teaching.
All right, Adam Smith, then name your worst teacher in your education career. Go ahead, Adam.
It would take me a while, but I was always in trouble. Maybe that's why.
That could have been very well it. Well, listen, as the son of a high school chemistry teacher who spent 41 years in a high school science department, I can tell you this, the teaching is the noblest of professions when done correctly. I have a great amount of respect for teachers. All right, we've got more to talk about here on the Florida Roundup, including gun violence back in the neighborhoods here in South Florida with the Hialeah Massacre. That comes up next here on the Florida Roundup. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. It was 1 week ago a Hialeah neighborhood was witness to that city's worst mass shooting. Pedro Vargas killed 6 people before police shot and killed him early Saturday morning. As investigators have traced Vargas's actions leading up to the mass murder, hours before the killing started, Vargas made this call to 911. Vargas telling the 911 operator he feels threatened. He's being a victim. Sorcery and stuff, he mentions. And eventually, Vargas's mother gets on the line with the 911 operator and after several minutes cancels the call, canceling any police response. Now, Mark, the Hialeah police have come out quick to defend the 911 call and the operator, saying, quote, the operator had no evidence at the time to believe or any reason to believe that anyone was in imminent danger. Among the tragedies in all this is Vargas was able to legally obtain a firearm. There doesn't seem to be any kind of large neighborhood debate or, quite frankly, regional conversation that has been sparked by this real awful tragedy in Hialeah in regards to guns and guns violence.
one of the there were many unfortunate victims of this, obviously. One of them was Carlos Gavilanes, who was walking into the building with his 9-year-old son and was shot by Vargas.
From across the street.
From across the street. And Gavilanes' father spoke out about the problems of mental illness and lack of gun control. So you do see it there, but in the end, it doesn't appear that people really knew Vargas was crazy at the time. There's a Second Amendment right that's been recognized by the U.S. Supreme Court to own a firearm. And just like people operating the incredibly dangerous machines known as automobiles, there are going to be crashes, there are going to be deaths, and with guns, there are going to be shootings, there's going to be deaths.
Adam Smith from the Tampa Bay Times. Sandy Hook Promise, which is a nonprofit formed by some Sandy Hook residents in the wake of that tragic shooting, issued a statement after the Hialeah massacre. Quote, "Our hearts are broken, our spirit is not, sending prayers and condolences to the victims and families of the Hialeah, Florida mass shooting. Another tragedy that invites us all to reflect on what individual and collective changes we can make as a nation to save lives. Together we can." End quote. So pick it up from that point, and really here a week after this tragedy, still open wounds, both literally and figuratively. Well, I guess more figuratively, unfortunately. But Adam, why not a deeper discussion sparked by these tragic shootings?
And of course, the Trayvon Martin case too. The wounds are still open there. There will be discussions, and I think the protesters that are camped out in Tallahassee have certainly brought a lot of attention to at least stand your ground. But ultimately, it's politics, and the politics in this state suggest gun control measures go nowhere. And for all the people that are outraged about stand your ground and the lack of gun control measures in the state, the Republican Party would love to continue having that debate, because they view this as nothing but a political winner, as largely Democrats are calling for changes to stand your ground or more gun control.
Adam mentions the George Zimmerman case, of course, is still fresh in everyone's mind, that he was acquitted of murder charges for killing Trayvon Martin. The cases obviously here, Mark, are not related in terms of the Hialeah tragedy and the Zimmerman case, but both do involve guns and both involve perpetrators who legally obtained their firearms.
Again, with the Second Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, I don't know what could have been done in either of these cases, except for the fact that I wish these guys would have been more responsible. Obviously, yeah. Vargas was off his rocker. Zimmerman was certainly paranoid and, in my opinion, not responsible with carrying a firearm. But to Adam's point, a Democratic pollster, Democrats have told me that this is basically a losing issue for them. There are two realities with guns or perceptions. There are the rural and more sub or ex-urban voters who view guns as a cultural and freedom issue, a litmus on government intrusion. In urban areas, primarily minorities who are both the perpetrators and victims of gun violence.
It's an important point.
It's perceived as a crime and safety issue. They're having totally different conversations about the same phenomenon.
Well, in comes Jesse Jackson into this debate a little bit this week here, Adam, in Florida. He was in Tallahassee saying that our state's guns laws were, quote, Selma of our time. Of course, a reference to civil rights marches in Alabama. Governor Scott, others demanded an apology right away. It's not coming. Does this forward the conversation at all when we see this kind of inflammatory language?
No, but it was clearly a great gift to Rick Scott, who certainly doesn't want to be talking about all the turmoil and the departing education commissioner. He'd much rather be chastising Jesse Jackson, who is the people who are big fans of Jesse Jackson's are not voters who are going to be voting for Rick Scott.
Well, and to that point, right, Mark, I mean, didn't Jesse Jackson do Governor Scott a favor in terms of coming to the state and acting like the lightning rod that he can in these instances by providing the ability of Rick Scott supporters and gun supporters to be able to rally around against that kind of statement?
It's not only that. We have to look at the racial politics of things. Frequently we talk about, oh, immigration is going to affect the Hispanic vote and help Democrats. And gun violence is going to gin up the black vote and help Democrats. But let's not forget that when Jesse Jackson comes and calls Florida an apartheid state, when he compares it to Selma in one way or another, that this is going to upset a lot of white voters, a lot of white swing voters in the state who are either gun owners or more favorably inclined toward that sort of thing. So to Adam's point, this is Jesse Jackson gave Rick Scott a nice campaign contribution, certainly an in-kind.
Join the conversation, 800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN. It's the Florida Roundup. I'm Tom Hudson, Mark Caputo of the Miami Herald with us, Adam Smith from the Tampa Bay Times. Adam, I'm just curious, in terms of the Gulf Coast, what kind of coverage and what kind of public response have you seen over the past week or so in regards to the Hialeah tragedy?
Well, it hasn't. It's received attention, but obviously not nearly as much attention as it has in South Florida. But it's been on the news. It's been in the papers,
sure.
But it hasn't been an ongoing story.
But there hasn't been any necessarily local reflection or something. It's and isn't that what's so unsatisfying about this, Mark, is that we mark it up. Here we are a week after the fact, and we move on to the education commissioner quitting. Meantime, a half dozen people have lost their lives needlessly.
I think it's a reflection of the fact that these things happen, and while it's I'm sorry to sound so coarse, while the high body count is news, the fact that someone got shot really isn't, especially when you look at our statistics. The violent crime rate is dropping, the homicide rate is dropping, people go about their daily lives, and then let's just look at what people are focused on. A lot of people would rather talk about Anthony Weiner and his sexcapades in New
right.
York than this sort of thing. It's partly also a referendum on our attention span.
Well, according to reports, the Florida Agriculture Commissioner says its office issues between 10,000 and 15,000 permits every month in the state of Florida.
I think we're at 1.15 million concealed weapons in Florida. I understand it's a state of about 19 million people total. That's a lot of concealed weapons, and that's just concealed weapons owners. There's a lot more gun owners out there who don't have the permits.
And we're number one.
We're
not number one in everything, but we are in concealed weapons.
We are the gunshine state.
Is that something that that Floridians ought to be proud of, both politically as well as culturally?
I'm not so sure about that.
Mark, you want to tackle that one?
As
a native Floridian?
Well, I'm not really a native Floridian, but...
educated.
But I'll resist the temptation there. In the end, this is a gun-happy state. In the end, yes, in the inner cities, in urban areas, it's looked down upon. But my experience, having reported from Key West to Tallahassee and lived all places in between, folks here like their guns.
Bob joins us from Miami here on the Florida Roundup. Bob, but go ahead.
Yes, thank you. I was wondering, I mean, will it take a massacre of thousands by some group of insurrected crazies for the Washington House of Representatives Senate to finally amend the Constitution to have guns in the hands of only responsible people?
Bob in Miami asking a question that we tend to ask quite frequently when these kinds of tragedies come up, and we've seen it outside of the country, massacres in for instance, in countries with extremely tight gun laws like Norway, where dozens of people get gunned down at a summer camp, and yet the debate continues, but perhaps the policies also continue without much change. We've got to leave it there here on this Florida Roundup. We want to thank our quartet of top journalists. Adam Smith joining us from Tampa Bay Times. Thank you, Adam. Mark Caputo from the Miami Herald. Read his column in the Herald covering politics and all other things, despite his one schoolroom education here in Florida. Of course, we're kidding about that. Sammy Mack from WLRN covering education throughout South Florida and doing a great job of it. And John O'Connor, State Impact Florida, helping out with education reports throughout the Sunshine State from WUSF. This is the Florida Roundup, and we will be on Facebook, of course, and the program remains at 6 a.m. Tomorrow if you'd like to listen to a rebroadcast. It's produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman, our public insight network analyst Steph Farrow, our executive producer for WLRN Peter J. Mayers. Our technical supervisor is Paul Leary, doing a wonderful job making sure all the buttons run on time. Thank you, Paul. Stay tuned here on WLRN. South Florida Arts Beat is next. Be sure to join us Monday morning at 9 a.m. for the Sunshine Economy. We'll take a look at the fashion industry here in South Florida. How well-dressed are you? How well-dressed is that industry? 9 a.m. here on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.